From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made during the cold and stormy summer of 1816 near the shores of Lake Geneva. 19-year-old Mary Shelley was experiencing one of the most, if not the most, creative and productive periods of her life. It was during this summer that she wrote her famous novel, Frankenstein. The novel, of course, is a classic now, and it remains as popular today as it was during Shelley's time. You may have seen film adaptations of the book, but you may not have thought much about the narrative's themes of flirting with the supernatural, nature versus nurture, good versus evil, and many more. There's a new book that explores these themes and some of Frankenstein's so-called stepchildren. It's called Monstrous Progeny, and its co-authors are joining me on the program today. I'd like to welcome Les Friedman, professor and former chair of the Media and Society program at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and co-author of the book. Welcome, Les. Glad to have you back.
Thank you.
And on the phone with us is Allison Cavey, an associate professor of early modern history at CUNY John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, and also a co-author of the book. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Allison.
Hi, Les, how are you?
Good.
The team is reuniting. Before we get started talking about the book, I know there's an event coming up at the George Eastman Museum, in which is tied to the book itself. Les, did you want to share a little bit about what
Sure, I actually call this a Frankenfest.
Oh, a Frankenfest.
And it's a series of films featuring prints that the Eastman House has. So they're beautiful prints of various Frankenstein films. And I'll give you quickly, Megan, the dates. The first one is tomorrow at 8 o'clock at the Dryden Theater. And I'm going to introduce the original Frankenstein, 1931, and sign books, hopefully sell books, but sign books as well. Then let me give you the other dates just quickly. August 10th, they're doing Bride of Frankenstein, which many, many people think is the best Frankenstein film ever made. On August 17th, they're doing Son of Frankenstein, which is a Hammer film, British film production. August 24th, they're doing Flesh for Frankenstein. That's basically Andy Warhol's film. And let me warn you not to eat before you see this film. It's pretty gruesome. Or grossome, if I can invent a word. And then on August 27th, they're doing Kenneth Branagh's attempt at a real faithful adaptation, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein from 1994. So all of you Franken fans out there can look forward to this wonderful series at the Eastman House, the Dryden Theater.
Thank you. We'll be sure to post those links to those dates on the podcast page for this episode if you're interested in learning more. Before we start talking about the book, I think we should talk a little bit about Mary Shelley's novel, because when you hear the word Frankenstein, sometimes an image pops right into your head. Maybe it's the monster. And I think there's some confusion out there sometimes about who Frankenstein actually is. Some people may think that the monster is called Frankenstein if they haven't read the book or seen a film. So let's just talk about plot points in the novel to establish kind of a foundation for those who may not be totally familiar with the book.
Right. Well, and Allison, join in anytime, of course. The novel is, Stephen King said a long time ago that if it hadn't been for the movies, the novel would have been the province of English graduate students, because what does pop in your mind inevitably is that picture of Boris Karloff, which is copywritten, so don't try to use it as well. But the novel differs a great deal from the film. In particular, the monster, and we don't call him the monster, I think we call him the creature most of the time. The creature is very, very articulate. In fact, incredibly smart. He teaches himself to read. He teaches himself to write and to talk. And at times, he really rises to a level of, I think, morality above his creator. But the idea is that the creature is rejected by his maker. And one of the things I do when I teach the novel is to talk about the creature in two ways. One, as a person with a disability, he is, of course, ugly, big, scarred. And two, as an abused and abandoned child. So I think that is a way to think about the novel in very, very contemporary terms.
What did you think of the 1931 film? Do you think some of the plot points and the characters are different from the novel? Do you think that it misrepresents the novel in a way that is confusing to audiences?
They all misrepresent the novel. There's no authentic Frankenstein film. In the book, for example, the creation scene is, what is it, Allison, three sentences?
But yeah, it's a very short paragraph with no detail at all.
None. So we don't know how the hell he created this creature. But of course, when you're doing a visual medium, you change it. They saw the visual possibilities. It's a different creature. It's right. A different creation. It's a beautiful, beautiful film in all sorts of ways. And interestingly enough, Karloff not speaking adds to the poignancy of this rejected, quite sympathetic creature.
How long did it take you to write the book together? I know it's a labor of love.
I don't know if it continued to be love over the years. It was a labor of I don't know what. What was it, Allison? 4 years, maybe?
I think it was three. Although, to be fair, we both did some other significant projects as well as this one at the same time. So we were dividing our attentions and then coming back to this with increasing anxiety to get it done.
This is our second book together, and we're still talking. The first book, Allison came in. Allison was, as it says in the preface, fairly obsessed with Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. And so she leaned on me to do Peter Pan with her, and it was great, actually. I really did learn a lot, and writing with Allison's great fun. And then I leaned on her, and I said, okay, I did Peter Pan. Now we do my obsession, Frankenstein. And I think it took us longer with Frankenstein because the first book was an anthology of other people's writing as well as our own. And there were moments of contestation. And differences of opinion, which is always kind of fun to work out in retrospect. And
I think one of the things that's so interesting about working with someone from a different discipline is that we use evidence differently. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I'm a historian and I'm trained in the sort of producing the historical context for something and really using that as evidence. So if the historical context does not support a reading, then I find it hard to go with it. Whereas Les is trained as a literary scholar and a media scholar, and so his evidence is in the text. And so we had these interesting discussions where he said, for example, our big conflict was over Paradise Lost and its importance as the sole religious context or reference for the book. And I said, but that's ridiculous. She clearly would have read the Bible. There's no way she didn't know the Bible. In fact, it seems likely to me that Genesis is a really important story here and that the stories of creation in the Old Testament have to be attended to because she's playing with them. She's referencing them as much as she's referencing Milton, which is not to say she does not reference Milton. She deliberately does. But to this point, English scholarship has really solely referenced Milton, and I felt like there was very strong evidence, both in the novel and historically, to say, we know she read the Old Testament. Why would she ignore it?
Right. And sadly, Allison was right. I mean, that's what happened. I remember once I said something, Allison, I said, well, you can't prove that. Mary Shelley, there's no evidence that Mary Shelley read that. That's just your opinion. And Allison said, you've built a whole career on your opinions. And it was true. It's true. It is a different way of thinking about the process.
How did you first?
We do have her library. We actually do know some extent what she read. Of course, she read outside of the library as well, but we do know most of what she read.
So speaking of what she read, the first chapter of the book is about the intellectual history of that period of time. And there was this movement from science of the Renaissance era way of thinking, I guess for lack of a better term. Help me out here, Les.
No.
Into more of a peer-reviewed theory. And so tell us a little bit about why that period of time is so important to the novel itself and why that context is important for people to understand.
Well, this is Allison's specialty.
All right, Allison, take it away.
Okay, thank you. So I think there are sort of three big time periods that you need to understand. The Renaissance, which is my specialty, where people were trying to understand the ways in which God created the world and humans could manipulate it to achieve their desired ends using either magic or natural philosophy, which later becomes science. And then there's what we call the Scientific Revolution, which is sort of 17th to 18th century. And that is the period you most likely associate with Boyle and Newton and Galileo, which is to say a time in which science became formalized and standardized according to a method. And then it's by the 19th century that you see peer review or institution-oriented science emerge as the way to do science. And during these three periods, a lot of things changed. Certainly the professionalization of science is something that's been well established, but I'm really interested in the way the questions scientists asked changed. So Mary Shelley, in this novel, produces a critique of the questions that Renaissance scientists asked and says that those questions were dangerous because they produced people who believed they could equal divine power. And that was a critique during the Renaissance as well, certainly of Renaissance magicians. And the formalization of science, the institutionalization of science that is supported in the novel resulted in smaller, more manageable, more human questions that took God out of the equation, which is not to say God is not in the book, but it is to say that science is to be strictly separate from questions of creation and trying to solve the big questions of eternal life and omnipotence.
Well, yeah, and one of the reasons that so many critics see Shelley's Frankenstein is important is that unlike the creation of creatures prior to this, one thinks of the Golem of Rabbi Lowe, one thinks of Faust, is that Mary Shelley used science, though Allison knows a lot about the history, their PhD is in the history of science, knows a lot more about it than I do, but so I'm using the word generally. Mary Shelley takes, as she's saying, God and the supernatural out of the equation and uses, at least by the time we get to the films, electricity and scientific methodology. And so it's a shift in thinking about the process.
And there's also a societal component to how science was viewed. So if you were a gentleman, can you talk a little bit about that, Allison? The gentleman scientist was more revered than and this all relates to the polar sea, and I'm certainly not going to do this justice. So, Allison, can you explain how being a gentleman scientist was more valued than someone who could steer a ship, for lack of better words?
Absolutely. So Stephen Chapin has established really beautifully that being a gentleman was a big part of establishing your scientific credibility, particularly in 17th century aristocratic society. People like Boyle were doing science and attesting to their results with their social status being sufficient to prove that they had accomplished what they said they had. And we see a very long history of this. For example, a lot of people said they made the Philosopher's Stone or the ingredients of the Philosopher's Stone, and they were believed not just because people were gullible, but because their status as scientists and as men guaranteed that they could have. People like whaling captains, on the other hand, tended to be from lower class. They were not educated, and their experience, although very valuable from our perspective, was not particularly valued at the time because they were not socially respectable. And so there's a big contest in the 18th century in the Royal Society, which is the big institution in London, governing how science is done and who can do science, about the open polar sea. Now, of course, you're laughing your head off, right? polar sea, except the one we've created with global warming. But at the time, they were relying on an ancient text by Pliny, the Natural History, which said that there was an open polar sea, that if you went all the way to the top of the world, you would find this tropical paradise within the ice. And so, despite the fact that whaling captains who had overwintered many times by mistake because they got stuck in the ice and had sledged miles and miles and miles to survive trying to find seal so that they could eat and feed their crew, they knew there was no open polar sea. But in the Royal Society, gentlemen said, of course there had to be, because Pliny said there was, and he's an ancient authority, and we believe him, and we're going to go find it. And so, really, thousands of pounds were spent sending these ships out. The HMS Navy was sort of repurposed after the French and English War to go out and find the open polar sea, and also to do Arctic exploration, to find valuable minerals. Of course, gold is everybody's dream. But also minerals, animals, etc. So there's a scientific and an economic goal of exploration. But they were looking quite explicitly for the open polar sea. And Walton, who everybody forgets in the novel, he's the guy who finds Victor when he stumbles in across the ice. He is a gentleman who is self-educated. He's not quite gentlemanly enough to have made it to one of the big universities. Mm-hmm. Much like Victor, he studied at home. And he is recovering from some sort of economic failure. He had tried to be a poet. It didn't go well. So now he's captaining this ship, and he really has no idea what to do out on the ice. And he starts to listen too much to Victor, and he thinks, oh, we should stay here because we'll find this open polar sea. I know we will. And then I'll be famous like my friend Victor. And Victor actually pushes him to do that for a bit. But then the crew says, look, buddy, if we stay here another 3 days, right, we're going to be here all winter. And we've done that. We're and we like die. All 10 of our fingers, every single one of us. We want ears, we want noses, and we want to go home. And so in the end, in a very compelling speech, he chooses, with Victor's help, family, country, and manageable accomplishment over being a hero. And so it's this really interesting reconciliation of ancient knowledge and experiential knowledge, and social class mediating the ways in which knowledge can be understood and valued, right, in an exploratory context.
Yeah, and Allison makes a point that we can see in a contemporary setting as well. I mean, I am sure I'm speaking to the converted out there when I say that one of the things we all struggle with is our career versus our home life. How do we balance our work life, particularly when we're passionately engaged in something? I know when I'm writing, you know, I may not see my wife for long periods of time. And that Frankenstein has pushed that out of proportion, because one of Victor's errors is that he rejects, ironically, exactly what the creature wants. He rejects male friendship with Clarabelle and a heterosexual love with Elizabeth. So, you know, that's a very modern theme. How do we balance our professional passions with our personal home life? And Frankenstein, as a novel, really deals with that theme. Unfortunately, Victor makes a bad choice.
Mm-hmm. And that's really tackled in the films as well.
I think it is.
How do you feel about the 1931 film?
I think it's a great film. I mean, if you were to push me to the wall, I would say The Bride's a better film, mm-hmm, just because it's funnier to me. It's very clever. And just because Whale, the director, had more control of it. But if you particularly haven't read the novel, and I want to get back to one of your early questions, Megan, because there's an answer to this. What happened? Because the first time I ever taught the film after reading the novel, I thought, where did all of this stuff come from? Well, where it came from, because you've read the book, you know, is 100 years of theatrical productions in between the book and the film, the 1831, the second publication, and the 1931 film. There were hundreds of plays. And by the time it came around to being a script, all that stuff, like, there's no assistant in the book. And as I said before, the monster is quite literate in the book. Now you got me saying monster. The creature is quite literate. and many, many other things are in the book that are in the film and are in the film that are not in the book. So, but that's almost always the case with any film that's made of a book. It cannot be exactly the book.
Right, creative liberties.
Right.
I want to take a listen to a clip from that 1931 film. This is the famous scene in which the creature finally comes to life. So let's listen to that.
It's alive. It's alive. It's moving. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
Now I know what it's like to be God.
Now I know what it's like to be God. It's funny, my students, for weeks after we see this film, they go, it's alive, it's alive, you know. But it's a very famous scene, and if you watch this, and I hope some of you will come to the Eastman House tomorrow at 8 o'clock and get a chance to see this fabulous film. He's clearly crazy by this point. I mean, he hasn't slept, he hasn't eaten, he hasn't seen anyone, and he's created this creature. And in fact, one of the big things that always has bothered me about the film and the book is that Victor looks at his creature and is disgusted by his ugliness and rejects him. And you want to say to yourself, but wait a minute, you made him. You know he's 7 feet tall. You know he has a flat head and scars. Why are you surprised at this moment? And there's no answer to that. The only answer is the one I always give my wife when she makes a rational question. It's a movie. It's a movie, and that's it. But
it's the novel as well.
Right, it is in
the novel.
And
he's crazy as a loon in the novel as well by that point. He's exhausted. He hasn't eaten. He hasn't seen human beings in months. You know. And Mary Shelley devotes paragraphs and paragraphs to how much time he spent crawling around in charnel houses. So
and graveyards.
Gone a little bit over the edge just from that.
No, he has gone over the edge.
But he, I think his horror was at the creation.
Yeah.
Right, he goes through this extraordinary process, and yes, rationally, of course, he knows that this thing that he's created will be physically different than him. But I think it's the passion of that creation that quite literally overwhelms him. He thinks that this miracle should also make this thing beautiful.
And it doesn't.
No, of course not.
No. But, it's interesting. In the later, in the early Frankenstein films, the creature is rejected before he does anything evil, before he murders anybody. The creature is rejected simply on the basis of his looks.
Of being different.
Of being different. And, of course, we could talk about that theme for
right.
a whole lot of time. But in the later films, and I would include Ex Machina in this, the creature is beautiful and yet still rejected by society because of, and you put your finger on it, making a difference.
Right. And so is that, if someone were to ask you, why write a book about Frankenstein narratives? Why is it important to bring all these themes and ideas together? Is that something that you would stress? Is it teaches us about society in the past and even society today?
Well, I think it teaches us a lot. I mean, I've taught this book in different contexts. I've taught this book to English graduate students. I've taught it to medical students at the University of Rochester and at Upstate. And when I do medical students, I said earlier, I talk about the idea of disability. I mean, look, doctors, we can all turn away when we see something that upsets us, something that is ugly, for want of a better word. Physician, a healthcare worker, can't do that. They have to deal with a burn victim. They have to deal with someone who's got real physical problems. And the book asks us to consider how we deal with this. Now, Allison and I had really wonderful discussions about the idea of, is the creature a human being?
Mm-hmm.
And Allison, with her own background, she'll be able to talk about this, asked, does the creature have a soul?
Right.
And that's a crucial question, because if the creature has a soul, then to get rid of the creature is murder. And I don't know what the creature is if he doesn't have a soul. We just don't know.
And there's a whole section in the book about bioethics,
right.
Angels and demons, body and soul. How was that chapter to write? Was there a lot of debate between the two of you in determining some of your thoughts on that?
Well, Allison wrote the sort of philosophical soul stuff, and I wrote the bioethics stuff, but I think they fit together, frankly. I think those things combine. I mean, I think one of the surprises to us was how much was out there. You know, not only how many films, there's over 200 films with the name Frankenstein in it, not to mention all the other ones, probably double that, and tremendous amount of writing on it. And it's a challenge to write something new. I hope we did. And part of the discussion is exactly what we're talking about now. Is the creature human? What is human? And by the way, as we go along in our culture now with robots looking more and more human, and they're going to continue to look human, excuse me, with cloning, where someone is going to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's going to be able to do it, and it's going to raise an incredible amount of questions.
We need to take our only... Allison.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think one of the really relevant sets of questions that Frankenstein asks is what science can do versus what science should do, and how does humanity regulate science and scientists? Because if we just put science in scientists in charge of science, are we sure that the morality is always the one that we are ethically comfortable with? Because, you know, yes, Mary Shelley does applaud a peer-reviewed, institutionally-based kind of science, but I think in some institutions, ethics can be lost as well. And, of course, all you need to do is think of the race for the HIV virus between Gallo and the French lab, the Pasteur lab, and you can see that, in fact, sometimes for career ideals, people will start to make unethical choices that, in fact, had, about a three-decade-long set of repercussions on HIV patients.
Or Tuskegee, or the Nazis,
right?
You know, and we go down, we go down the list. You can't go through a day without mentioning the Nazis. I mean, you know.
No, good point.
Yes, thank you.
We need to take our only short break of the hour. Allison, we'll get right back to it in less than a minute. And when we come back, I do want to talk some more about films, because I think that's where most people's familiarity with Frankenstein comes in. So if you would like to weigh in and talk about your favorite Frankenstein movie, feel free. The number here is 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@wxxi.org. And I'm also on Twitter if you want to send a tweet. It's just mmacmedia. So your questions and comments and more on Frankenstein and films is next.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections. With the RNC finishing up, we turn our attention to the Democratic National Convention and a question for you. If you think about charismatic leaders, how many are women? New York Times Magazine recently posited the idea that we should redefine what we think charisma means because women are too often excluded. We'll talk about that on Monday.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We're ending our week with Frankenstein, talking about films and narratives and books and different representations in popular culture. And my guests today are Les Friedman. He's a professor at Hobart and William Smith College. And on the line is Allison Cavey from John Jay College in New York City. And before we went to break, I mentioned that we're going to be talking about some films now. And during the break, Les and I were talking about that's where most people find familiarity in Frankenstein, either the 1931 film, films before that, silent film. So let's start with the silent era and work our way up. And I know in your book you mentioned that during the silent era, the creature is, how can I phrase this? It was more psychologically soothing, the narratives in the silent film. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, obviously the creature didn't speak during the silent era. And there is a 1910 Edison version, which I think the Eastman House does have. That's probably the most famous one. And Fred Weibel has spent a decade putting together the pieces of this and actually creating what was shown then. And it's pretty interesting. What happens with the films, though, in the silent era is that, and the 1931 Frankenstein film is that God and religion creep into them in a more overt and pervasive way. Mary Shelley, I think, a lot of people disagree with this, but Mary Shelley, I think, does not condemn Victor Frankenstein for wanting this. I think she condemns him for his reaction and for not taking responsibility for what he has created, or perhaps even for not thinking through very clearly what he was going to do. The films, however, and in the book, people do talk about this a little bit, ask if Victor has violated the laws of God and nature. I'm not sure what those laws are, and I think they shift over time. And one has to ask, and Allison said it very articulately in the first part of the program, what are the limits of science? Because it can do something, should it do something or not? You know, and I sort of humorously said before, you can't get a day without Nazis. But obviously the Nazis are the prime example of this. So the silent era films start looking more like morality plays in which Victor gets punished for transgressing what only God should be able to do, which is create a life. And by the way, it's an interesting thought that, of course, this eliminates women from the birthing process as well. And feminist critics have really talked about that. But as you yourself said, Mary Shelley is, there were many, many childbirth deaths in her life around this time, including her own mother. Her mother died 11 days after giving birth to Mary of septicemia. And Mary, by all accounts, was quite guilty for the rest of her life.
And her mother was an esteemed feminist.
She was
feminist.
the first of the great feminists of Vindication of the Rights of Women, Mary Wollstonecraft. Interestingly enough, she grew up as Mary Godwin, which was her father's name, and he was a famous scientist, writer rather, and philosopher. But we know her as Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley.
Right.
And so she rejected her father's name and took on the mantle of her mother and, of course, Shelley's last name as well.
Mm-hmm. So after the silent era, we move into
Universal. Yeah, and Universal, what's going on at Universal is that they need money. And they have one big hit early on in Dracula. And they decide, well, that worked. Mm-hmm. Why don't we find ourselves another monster? So they basically commission Balderston, John Balderston. He takes Penny Webling. They give him a screenplay, and they give it to James Whale, who's this very arch, sophisticated gay. And that's important because the film has a gay subtext, and Bride of Frankenstein, it's no longer a subtext.
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Rocky Horror Picture Show is just taking that to the limit. But even in the early ones as well. And James Whale famously said he never read the novel. So he felt, he just looked at the screenplay and did what he was going to do. And of course, the big key here was Karloff.
Right.
And overnight he became famous. And there are lots and lots of background stories about that makeup and how he put it on. He had teeth pulled. Yeah, wisdom teeth, so he would have that look. And from there, the film was a phenomenal success. In fact, now, no one who's going to go to the Eastman House tomorrow is going to be scared of this film. But it was sold like that. In fact, some of the theaters had in front of them ambulances, women dressed as nurses and doctors, male doctors, in case some of the patients, some of the viewers, fainted. And of course, it was quite frightening to them to see this image. It's very common to us. We see it on cereal boxes. We've seen it in the Munsters,
Right.
But, and it's almost funny to us, but it was not to them at all.
It was a different time.
It was a very, very different time in 1931.
I want to jump to the phones because we have Kelly and Genoa listening on WEOS, and she has a question about an adaptation in terms of a TV show. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I haven't actually read Frankenstein. It's sitting on my nightstand, and one of the reasons I bought it, I was watching a series, Penny Dreadful.
Oh, you're hitting
a
good spot.
The whole, I think what was mentioned earlier with the rejection of the priest, he was so articulate. Actually, like,
Kelly, I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
let me tell you a good story. I was in England earlier this year, and we went to the National Theater out in the South Bank. We went to see Elizabeth McGovern in a play, and we were waiting outside to talk, see if we could talk to Elizabeth McGovern. And out of the door walks Rory Kinnear, who played the creature in Penny Dreadful. No one bothered to talk to him. I ran after him, and I said, I've written a book on Frankenstein. And he said, oh, let's talk about that. And Penny Dreadful is a fabulous monster mash. It's got not only Frankenstein, it's got vampires, it's got witches, it's got Dorian Gray, it's got Dracula. Who else am I missing? It's got everyone in there imaginable in that kind of mix. But it's a really an interesting recreation. And he creates a bride for her. as well. So I'm so glad you mentioned Penny Jetboil. It's over now, but you can get it. You can get the seasons, and it's well worth it.
I can't have this conversation without mentioning one of my favorite adaptations, which is Young Frankenstein.
Of course.
Love that Mel Brooks film. And it's rated one of the funniest comedies ever made.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of parody, it's probably one of the closest to the original. And talk a little bit about, because there's a section in the book just about Young Frankenstein. I encourage everyone to read it. It's very interesting.
Well, of course you mean Frankenstein.
Frankenstein,
yes. And again, my students do imitations of that. Let me tell you something that you will enjoy. When Mel Brooks was deciding to do the film, somehow, and I forget how he got this, but one of the old stagehands said to him, you know, I think we have the original set of the laboratory with that Strickland created somewhere here. And they found it. And so in Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks uses the original set that James Whale used in 1931, and then again in Bride of Frankenstein a few years later. I think Mel Brooks perfectly understands Mary Shelley. I think he understands that this is a father-son relationship, and he understands that the creature, he also, there's a very famous scene, of course, where he goes, "Who's on the Ritz?"
Right.
You know, he does put it on the Ritz. Well, what that's really about is how scientists use their creations for their own benefit and display them in what can be embarrassing and humiliating situations. But at the heart of that film is the idea of the father taking responsibility for the son.
Mm-hmm. And there's a very tender scene. It's the Hello, Handsome scene where...
Fabulous scene.
Gene Wilder is saying, you know, you are not evil. You are good.
You are an Olympian ideal.
Yes, and we can listen to that.
Oh,
we have that lined up in our list here. So let's take a listen to Young Frankenstein. And this is a scene of some emotional tenderness.
It is.
Hello, handsome. You're a good-looking fellow. Do you know that? People laugh at you. People hate you. But why do they hate you? Because they are jealous. Look at that boyish face. Look at that sweet smile. Do you want to talk about physical strength? Do you want to talk about sheer muscle? Do you want to talk about the Olympian ideal? You are a god! And listen to me. You are not evil. You are good!
Love that scene.
I do too.
Allison, how many times have you seen Young Frankenstein?
Oh, many. It was actually one of my father's favorite films, and so we watched it, I would say, probably once every few months for a little while there. And certainly I can quote long sections of it and from memory. It's a terrific film for sure, and certainly one that I think, as Les said, not only do I think that Mel Brooks understood Mary Shelley, but I think he does for the narrative or for the story what so many feminist scholars have kind of tried and not maybe succeeded in doing, which is to say he gives a mother to the creature.
Yes.
Because by putting into Gene Wilder's mouth the words of a Jewish mother, he actually does fully actualize the creation process and play with gender in a really interesting and fun way without being obnoxious and using multisyllable words in a lot of Judith Butler. So I appreciate that as an accomplishment, both academic and entertainment.
No, I think so, too. And once we get to gender, you mentioned earlier, we have to go to Rocky Horror.
Right. Before we do that, though, let's talk. Tom in Greece wants to comment on Young Frankenstein. So, hi, Tom.
I was going to call up and ask if you had seen Young Frankenstein or what you thought of Young Frankenstein, because I don't think that's on the list that you're going to be showing at the
Dryden. No, it's not, unfortunately.
No. Yeah, I know. I've seen that film. It's one of my favorites. I've seen it several times, but somebody got to you before it. But I think, one of my favorite scenes from that is when Madeline Kahn and Peter Boyle, the monster, are in bed together. They're like a married couple, sort of a bored married couple who have been together for several years. You know, which that sort of adds to the satire of it. You know, but I think also and Terry Garr was so good, but they all were good. But I think, of course, in the original, the 1931 film, which I've also read the novel, but it was quite a while ago. I didn't see the Kenneth Branagh film. Does he have the part about the boat and the ice?
Yeah, he does. It's one of the few films that includes the Walton section.
Yeah, okay.
But you know what's interesting about what you say? One of the questions, and I want to phrase this carefully because we are on radio.
Thank you.
The questions that is not quite resolved is the anatomical question, because they ask if, you know, Frankenstein in the book and in The Bride of Frankenstein and in Young Frankenstein, they ask for a bride to be created, but we don't know if he's capable of reproduction. We don't know if he's anatomically built. Let's just leave it at that. How about that? We'll leave it there.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, but I think we do. I think we do, because I don't think Mary Shelley would have put that plot point in if she wasn't going to give you the potential of a race of giant
creatures. You're probably right. I but in Young Frankenstein, they make a trade, right?
Yeah.
Remember,
of course, by Young Frankenstein, we know he is.
We know he is, right. We know he is by Young Frankenstein, and they trade some of that for the doctors, and he is a doctor in the film, if not the book, intelligence.
Mm-hmm. So moving back to your comment about gender identity and progressive roles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We can talk about Rocky Horror Picture Show for hours, probably. I have a clip from Rocky Horror Picture Show, but we'll hold on just a moment with that, John, our engineer, John Andrus. Moving to the board. Thank you, John. But in that film in general, let's talk about some of the similarities with the book and some of the major differences, of course.
And after the show is over, perhaps we could do the time warp again.
Sure,
we could do the time warp. I think that, Frankenfooter, here we go, no Freudian stuff going on here, is bisexual. We know he sleeps with men and women in the course of the film. And, of course, there's the famous picture of Tim Curry in his lingerie, as it were. And there's a lot to be, there are creations there, including the creature, including a former creature, Meatloaf.
Right, yes,
Meatloaf.
Eddie.
That's right, Eddie. And including a new creature, Rocky, who is desired by both men and women. I mean, when you look back at that film, the cast is unbelievable. I mean, Susan Sarandon and Tim Curry and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the film really pushes the gender issues about as far as they can go. Well, I must say Flesh for Frankenstein pushes them a little further, but in a much more grotesque and gross way. Boy, I'm really stirring up a crowd to go see that one, aren't I? I know. But certainly Rocky Horror and the addition of music.
Right.
Which is really quite interesting. And the discussion of Hollywood. I mean, don't dream it, be it. And the end on the RKO tower and how they die and all of that stuff is just really, really clever. I have been to, and I'm sure many listeners out there have been to, a Rocky Horror Midnight Show. And it's fascinating.
It's very fun.
It's great fun.
For those who haven't been, Les and Allison, if you've been, just share a little bit about what goes on during those live events.
Everybody dresses up as characters from the show. And not only that, they talk back to it. A character will show up and they'll scream, "Man's got no neck." Or they'll celebrate the wedding. They'll get up in the middle and dance. They all know the lyrics to everything. It is a trip and a half. They throw bread. They throw rice. They throw everything. I was once I was walking down a street in London over by the Prince Charles Theater, and I saw what appeared to me to be a golden drop of sun, and they were doing the same thing which was followed by a nun with a beard. They were doing the same thing with Sound of Music.
Oh, okay.
The same sing-along with the Sound of Music, but nothing's ever going to top the cult popularity of Rocky.
So we saw we heard the creation scene from the 1931 film. Now we're going to hear just after Rocky Horror is quote-unquote born or created in the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
the sword of Damocles is hanging over my head. And I've got the feeling someone's gonna be cutting the thread. Anyhow, woe is me. My life is a misery. Oh, can't you see?
Okay, so that's Rocky Horror, and right. Les and I were just talking about, as soon as he's created,
he knows
something's up, something's bad.
Yeah, but the difference here is that he's desired by everybody.
Right.
Not as the monster is, the creature is rejected by everybody, as it were. So I said that becomes different in a film like AI. The child is beautiful. The creature is beautiful. Blade Runner. They're beautiful. They're more human than human. And again, I said Ex Machina as well. It's interesting the evolution of these characters. Frankenstein has stayed the same in film after film after film. He is the doctor, sometimes the evil doctor, the scientist. But ironically, the creature has morphed into the hero and savior of mankind. I mean, if you look at the comic books, if you look at the I, Frankenstein movie, that was not a very good movie and didn't do all that well, but came out, the creature has become a far more sympathetic figure than the creator over time, which is a very strange morphing. And everybody knows the image. Nobody knows the image of Colin Clive, who played Dr. Frankenstein. Everybody knows the image of Boris Karloff.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to the phones. Catherine in Fairport wants to weigh in. Hi, Catherine.
Hello there. I used to teach books and films on the college level, and we would always do Frankenstein, the book, and then we would watch the film. Sometimes, however, the version that I ordered from a catalog would leave a scene out, and the scene is when the creature is walking through the open air, and he sees a little girl dropping some leaves or flowers into a pond, and she's got a dress with little flowers, and then he picks her up and throws her into the pond. Mm-hmm. And there are times when the version I got left that scene totally out, and I wonder, do you know that the version you're going to be showing will have that scene in it?
I hope you come, by the way. It would be great to talk to you, because I started as an English major before I went to the dark side and teach film. But I did that same thing, that same kind of course that you did, and I always taught Frankenstein and the book and the film. I haven't seen this version, but I would be totally surprised if that scene was not in it. It's a very important scene because, as you know, he does it totally by accident, and yet that is the death knell for him.
You explain the scene itself?
Comes across a little Maria, she's called, and she's sitting by a pool, and he's wandering around. He doesn't quite know what's going on, and he decides to join her, and no one has been kind to him, but she doesn't seem to reject him. And she has a little flower, and they take turns throwing the petals in the water. And finally, there's no more petals, and as part of the game, he picks her up and throws her in, and she drowns. And actually, the caller's right. It's one of the strongest scenes in the film, and the next scene is incredibly strong also. The father walks through the town with the dead child, the drowned child, in his arms, and that's what arouses the populace.
Right.
With the classic pitchforks and torches, and the mob goes after the creature.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Catherine. Thanks for commenting on that.
Thank you for letting me speak about that.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
See you Monday.
We're down to our last couple minutes, and I want to talk about the last chapter in the book, which is called 50 Ways to Leave Your Monster.
We were tired by then. We were tired of the monster.
So this really is a section about Frankenstein and pop culture.
Yep.
So, Allison, what was the biggest surprise to you, or maybe the biggest? Well, I guess surprise is the right word. Where did you find Frankenstein where you weren't expecting him?
Okay, so last Sunday I had the first afternoon off that I've had in quite a long time. I've been very busy, and I enjoyed my afternoon off by catching up on the TV show Grey's Anatomy. So here I am watching, binge watching like a crazy person, season 11. And it's a reprise of Frankenstein.
It never
and
ends.
At season 11, episode 18, Derek comes back from Washington and he says, I don't know why I went to the National Institutes of Health to do this crazy scientific experiment, leaving my family and my children behind. I'm a doctor. I can save lives with my hands. When did that stop being enough? I want to wake up every morning with my wife and see my children. I don't need to gene map the human creation. Mm. When did my hands stop being enough? And I turned it off and I thought, when is Frankenstein going to go away?
Yes.
I'm going to spend the rest of my life seeing these reprises. And I think what's important is how relevant the questions are and what a fascinating narrative it is. I do not love Victor Frankenstein. In fact, as you might have noticed in chapter two, I pretty much castigated him ferociously for being a self-involved twit. But the questions that the novel asks are important. The creature is an extraordinary thing, that being who interrogates what we mean when we say human, what we mean when we say alive, and pushes us to think better and more articulately about the kinds of things science can and should do and what it means to be human and do science. So for me, the repercussions in pop culture are valuable and interesting and fun.
Mm-hmm. And listeners, you can read much more about this in the book. It's called Monstrous Progeny. Les, where can you find the book?
You can find the book on Amazon.com, and you can find it tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in the Dryden Theater and signed by me.
There you go. Signed in person. Thank you, Les. Thank you, Allison,
welcome,
for joining me for this very fun hour. And thanks to our engineer, John Andrus, behind the glass. Our intern is Duprina Godboldo. Evan Dawson will be back on Monday. I'm Megan Mack. Have a great weekend.